Accession number 19048, reel 2.
Okay, so that's Harry Boardman, reel 2. And I think you were about the night before D-Day, and you just won a prize or something, Harry, hadn't
yes,
you?
Yes, in the Regent Ballroom in Brighton.
Yes.
In fact, as of course I was helping to escort the Colonel to the meeting in this other place in Brighton. Mm-hmm. And then we went back to the unit and quite frankly slept where you could when, you know, D-Day started.
Because
incidentally, I was in the East Lancashire Regiment then, did I mention?
No, you didn't. You didn't mention you'd been transferred to the East Lancashire.
I had. Because otherwise, the South Lancs Regiment were the first to actually go. And that was a thing that always worried me slightly. The first ones get me.
I think you were telling a story earlier off tape, Harry, weren't you? That it worried you because the person that went instead of you
was in yes.
You never knew his fate.
No,
but
and he was married and children.
Yes. But yeah. The reason that you didn't go, you said, was that because you played rugby or something.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so that was that. So we were in this, with these colonels in this big house in Brighton and so on, and then they all went back to the units and they were all sleeping where they could and everything like that. And to go on the boats and ships and everything like that. And we did earlier hours of the morning, went on to a big sort of like a tanker really. It was really a bit of a rough thing and so on, but we got on the thing and went off and so on in the morning and everything, and several waves of people had already gone and the thing had started when we got there. And the tide, they'd planned it, of course, that they would go in as the tide went in and they would go off and away.
Yes.
And the others, of course, had done so. But we were now too late, piled up behind, you know, queuing up behind and ships and everything like that. Till now, the cycle of the tides going in and going out had altered. It was now going out, you see, it was going back. But we were on the deck and everything had to go on, so and so. So finally they said, well, get all your things down. So you had to try to get the whole of the anti-tank platoon of guns and carriers and everything like that onto one huge flat thing. And the idea was that some ducks or something they were called would come in and hook on and drag you to the thing. Well, of course it didn't happen. There was nothing dragging you anywhere. You were just going backwards all the time. And I know I remember I had an overcoat on, two things on top of me, two of these leather jerkins as well, when you were only supposed to have one, and so on. And the thing is, it never dawned on me, if I did fall in, I'd just go down in natural fact. All I was thinking about was getting down. And of course, you had been for months sealing up all your vehicle and everything like that. Oh, you went through it so often, it was unbelievable.
For waterproofing.
Well, we set off, we got under this great big thing, you see, and then they unhitched it at the back and so on. But nobody was taking any notice of us. There was nobody there to pick us up or signal and everything like that. There were just people way on the beach waving sort of different things, come on, or whatever it was, we don't know. And we were just going backwards all the time rather than forwards with this tide going out. So finally somebody shouted, or somebody said, go. So I said, right, go. And I said to my gunner, you know, first of all, there was a Lloyd carrier on the front with me in the back, in command of this big thing, you see. And the gunner, still there, that from, oh, I forget his name. In fact, I've got his photograph on there. In fact, on the postcard. And he's a good driver and a good cook, in actual fact, as well. He'd worked in, I think, and to tell somewhere. Anyway, go. So he tried, clang, 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 clang. Anyway, finally we shot off into the water, glug, 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 and we never saw the guns or the carriers or anything ever again after that. We managed to get, and I managed to throw my stuff off and that, and lay on the floor like a drowned rat. But did manage to get on the with the Donar, the motorcyclist. He was the other one who'd, you know, scooted off on the bike and got going and so on. So him and I were on the beach and there was nobody, you know, near that who knew anything about anything.
What about your driver, the cook?
He had gone somewhere else, in actual fact.
Right.
But, you know, we'd gone down, and that. Mm. And he'd gone somewhere else with somebody else. And everything. Anyway, I got, like a drowned rat and got all this kit off and everything. And bullets were going to and fro and so on and everything like that. And rushed to a sand dune and whatever. And there we stayed for ages and ages. Nearly half a day and that until night came. And then of course night was a bit of a nightmare, really. You didn't know who was walking about on the beach, whether he was one of yours or one of them, you know, with a whole pintle helmet, I suppose. And stayed there, and then finally tried to contact our own unit. We couldn't find anybody or anything. I know it was about nearly 2 or 3 days before we even, you know, contacted the people who we should have done.
So just to recap there, Harry, you were supposed to, initially you were thinking you would go on June 6th with the South Lancashires, but just prior to that, a day prior to that, you were transferred to the East Lancashires. Mm. Because they didn't want you to go because you were a rugby player.
That's right.
And you eventually went over with a gun team who you were in charge of as part of the East Lancashires.
That's right.
1st Battalion East Lancashire Regiment.
I'd been with them actually for about 5 or 6 months, in actual fact.
Yeah.
Been with them for 5 or 6 months. Right. But I didn't know people by name or, you know, anything like that.
Can you remember, just to go back a little, can you remember where you sailed from to cross the channel?
Well, it was nearly in the dock area.
Of London?
Yes, we were in dock areas. We weren't on beaches and things like that. No, we were in wherever it was. We'd been... Yes. And then we got on the boat. Dear me, where was it? No, I couldn't.
No. It's okay.
I couldn't quite remember.
So we go back. You're on the beaches. You said there were bullets flying around you at that stage.
Yeah.
And then presumably you move off the beach eventually.
Yes. I think it was about nearly a day and a half before we moved off. We found somebody of our unit, you know, and went to together. And then, quite frankly, it was quite some time before we got really organised, because we were looking for our or our big stuff, you know, the guns and all that. We never got them back again. We had to have other people's.
Yes.
Six-pounders and whatnot.
They were replaced. The guns that you lost on the beach.
Yeah, yes. I don't know how we finally got the rest. Mm. You know, it took us quite some time to get organised, to really get organised.
Do you remember where you moved to from there? Where you moved inland to? Do you remember where?
You are no, I can't quite remember the names. You know, Wild Bull, whatever, and that sort of thing. I can't remember the names. Mm. No, I can't.
Well, the name that you mentioned there, Wild Bull, was August the 12th.
Was it?
Mm. And you landed on the beaches around June the 24th, June the 25th, something like. And you moved your way down from the beaches eventually to Wild Bull on August 12th. But in between there was some action around a place called Hill 112. Does that ring any bells with you?
No. No, it doesn't, actually.
Would have been just west of Caen.
Yes, it was around Caen where we were, really, all the time. As I say, I remember this business of walking in the cathedral and taking the hats off. And by then, incidentally, we'd had change of command. And in fact, we had this chap. What did we call him? Not flat. Or used to have a nickname for him, which he didn't mind in the least. He was ex-paratrooper. In fact, he was an ex-paratrooper, second lieutenant.
Mm. You said earlier, Flash Harry or something?
Something like that.
Did you say?
Yeah, something like that, you know, but he just didn't mind, you know. He's real. In fact, I did a thing a while ago, quite some time ago, having tree planted in his name in a place.
Mm. Mm.
So yeah, Flash Harry. I'm sure that's right. Yeah.
What were you doing at this part of that time in the war? You still had this gun crew?
Oh no, we got all reorganized then, you know, and then we got the gun crews organized, and then we went, doing our stuff. But a lot of the time, we were doing a lot of strange things. We got to, one of the things I remember really was, we got to a French village where there's a road down here and a road down here and a corner shop. There was a corner caterer's shop, wonderful cakes they would have and everything, and this corner, on this corner. And the seigneur's house was just over one side, and roads came different ways, and we had to watch one side and the other side. So I organised a wonderful system. The driver, who was a marvellous cook, he's living today, I forget his name, in actual fact, he got his photographs in there. I wouldn't say wasn't a good soldier, but he was a bloody good cook. I think he was a cook from the Midland Tell in Manchester or somewhere like that. And he could cook certainly the better meal than I've had today from nothing, in actual fact. Always he managed to cook us very good whatever you could get out of bully beef and everything like that. Half the time I didn't bother with the bully beef and so on. We just scrounged what was going. And being this caterer's shop, there was all things like flour, there was everything that they had stored and so on. And the window, great big window, you know, where they would have the display of fruit and of cakes and everything like that, came about this high from the bottom of the floor.
2.5 feet.
Yes. And on this corner, on the other side was difficult. So we had problems then of how to organise it everywhere. So the cook chap, who incidentally, when he's hearing, wasn't too good at being the soldier, he had to sit in the middle of this building on a chair and had a wire attached to him, you know, from one side, and another wire attached to him from the other things, and he was the central system of my organisation for notifying somebody coming. And unfortunately, it sometime became a thing of
both arms. Both arms have been pulled at once.
You know, so-and-so, come, where I shall never forget that place, in actual fact. And there was a German soldier underneath the window outside doing, dying, in actual fact. He was wounded. And Jono, who's Jono?
Johnson.
Johnson, the big Johnson, the big...
Yes.
Doing, so he's died, hasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Johnson was the big, I can do this, and he could, you know, sort of thing. You know, he's spraying me bullets and everything like that. And I said, well, he's wounded. Try and do something, you know, try and do something for him. And he did try to get under the window ledge, drop down to see to this wounded soldier, German soldier, who died in actual fact in the meantime. Anyway, we got him back. But this business, he will always remember this chap who was
the cook, the chef.
The cook chap. How we were always, oh, you know, we went through about 2 days of this. It must have been an absolute nightmare for him, in the dark, doing this business. And the colonel came along, the little colonel. Did you know him? Of course you wouldn't. The colonel came
along. Burden with this
Burden, Colonel Burden, who was a real Tartar, but knew each individual, you know. Well, Boardman, he said, you've done a very good thing, and if you... Words as good as said, if you're all right alive tomorrow, you'll, you know, be little heroes type thing. You know, he was really keen, very good with the. He was with his adjutant and everything like that, but a real booster up of of your psyche and so on. And though we'd been at it all night, poor doings in the dark in this terrible place, it must have been awful for him. Being told, you know, what does three jerks mean?
Oh, you had it as fine as that.
So oh, yes.
Three jerks meant more than something different
yes.
to one jerk.
Oh, no, of course, yes. But it was all jerk. You know, we're all jerking at once. You know, there's something happening coming in here. And actual fact, when daylight really came on, it was just the windows broken of the shops of a catering shop, and just debris all over the floor, and not a soul or anything like that. The German had gone. The German had died, incidentally, underneath the window, and that. And well, we didn't bury everything like this. Don't dream.
Do you remember around this time? I mean, I suppose you must have been setting the gun up all the time, Harry,
but
setting the gun up and firing and shooting at whatever you were shooting at. You remember those?
Yes.
Take us through something like that was happening there.
Well, we were on one bridge, and we were on one. There's a river, in actual fact, I forget what it is, a river somewhere in France there. And the first we'd heard, you know, that we heard that Illustrated London News had done photographs of this. Thing where we were, and we were organised in such a way on this bridge as a great big pile of, because we had to be in the open. The Germans were going across that way. They had a lot of horse-drawn they're ordinary vehicles. They're every completely horse-drawn things, running across, they dash across this thing way up there, and we then get them that way. So it's because we, this big pile of old cartons and old what you call it, was really me and the John on the gunner, you know. Get him, that's what, you know, got it, you know, and so on. And this went on for quite some time with this just a pile of doing, and it showed it in the London Illustrated magazine. The chap came round and interviewed us, you know, from the thing.
Johnson, John O. Johnson, was your sergeant's gunner.
Yes, that's right.
What were you? You were a sergeant also at this stage.
Yes, but I was in charge of the whole thing. Yeah.
You were in charge of how many guns at that stage?
Four guns.
Four guns.
Each section, you had two. I was in charge of two sections, and each section had two guns, and of course, very often it could get not steamed up, but messed up and everything like that, and that could have to be abandoned rather than. Rather than get it going, because you couldn't have people coming along and doing nice things to it. You had to go along then, and you'd be a gun short. And then next time you'd get one from somebody else who, again, had either been killed or shot or whatever.
Do you remember a man called Sergeant French?
Oh, yes. Froggy French, yes.
If I just remind you of a little thing that happened, because you mentioned Wild Boo.
Yeah.
Now, in the village of Boilbeau on August the 12th, Sergeant French fired his gun, some solid shots, through the town hall.
Yes.
Does that ring any bells with
you? Well, it's a kite type of thing, yes, but it dawned on me, yes. Mm. But I'd never heard of it going through the town hall, but yes. Mm. Yes, it probably could.
Basically demolished the town hall
that's right.
building, because I think there were some German people in there, and they had to clear them, and it was solid shot that they used, apparently.
Yes. Mm. Oh, yes, no, I hadn't, no, really, yes.
But Sergeant French would have been one of the, in this group of four guns that you were in.
Oh, no, he had his own section.
I see.
There's six sections,
right.
And each section had two guns, two anti-tank guns.
Yes.
And, yeah, so it's quite some times in those places. And I used to pick up when we went to, of course, we always did a bit of looting, you know, not loot, I'm sorry, a bit of wandering around, you know. And you come to a hairdresser's shop, and of course, there was no hairdresser, he'd disappeared, and windows gone, and everything like that. But inside would always be little bottles of unbelievable cheap perfume, dreadful. But I found out how to, you know, make a little bit of a thing about this. Get all these sort of things, and then the next place you come, the little French girl, Madame, wanted a, you know, little bit of something. She'd never had any drinks, so she had one of these from Harry, and, monsieur, so, and combs, you know, from barber shops and everything like that were very, you know, comfortable.
Sought after little things.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, souvenirs for the Madame, you know.
I've never heard that, Harry. That's one of, you know, taking bottles of perfume and combs. I've heard people taking Lugers and
Beggars. Oh, well, of course, so did I. I was loaded with them. Well, not loaded with them, but I had a Luger, a beautiful Luger, and everything like that. Pinched, unfortunately, by British.
Yes.
Yeah, I went, you know, I had to go home, my brother died, and I had to go home and over Christmas period, and came back and all my stuff had been, and then, you'd never believe it, I used to, of course, in between things happening, you would go back for a little while one night to somewhere, and there'd be like Danny LaRue, I think he did bits of things, and various women dancers and different things, various ones, you know, all came along and did a bit of a thing in a town hall somewhere.
A bit of a show for the forces.
Exactly. And I used to go on with my army greatcoat, you know, my big army greatcoat, you know. And I would strip off my greatcoat slowly and show that it was lined with marten fur.
Marten?
Marten. You know, small martens?
Yes, I do.
Is that all right?
Sorry?
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that.
Okay.
Yeah. Lined with marten fur, my army greatcoat. You know, came down way past the knees because, you know, very cold, you know, and that did me well in when I went to Belgium for, you know, you're taken out of the line now and again to go for a weekend to, you know, like Belgium,
rest and relaxation,
different places like that. And I remember going to a theatre. No, the first time I went to an opera, that's right, the first time I went to the opera, I went to the opera in, I forget where it was, where the mussels are very well known, you know, the mussels.
Somewhere like Bruges?
You're drinking a bedpan. They have this quirk of giving you your food in a bedpan that's been warmed up and so on. Oh, it's it used to be a special cafe that did that sort of thing, you know. And I remember going to the opera there, and it was Il Trovatore. And at the end, you know, he's dying, he flings himself, well, she flings herself off the, you know, the ramparts of this castle where her boyfriend has been shot and so on. And she jumped. Oh, she was supposed to jump, you know, and everything like that. And all the scenery came down and show her standing by, and somebody else had just jumped. You know, a figure came, jumped. Thud. And then the part of his tower fell down and showed that she was still there with the manager, you know, whatever. So I didn't believe in opera after that. That was the first opera, real opera I went to, but now, of course, I'm an absolute opera fan, you know.
Of course, what got you onto that was your coat.
That's right, yeah, Martin Fair.
Yes. That you wore the first time you went to the opera.
That's right, I wore this Martin Fair. And it was a fur coat, and got the people in the farmhouse, you know, you always occupied, if you could, a farmhouse, or whatever, you know, and they all slept round. It was in the winter, but they had winter and summer things, and the lads in there, you know, the young men in the family, were huge, great big muscular 6 feet types. But of course they could drag out their guns out of all the mud and everything quite easily, you know. We got them to help, which of course we did. And then in the farmhouse itself, she sat down sewing this fur coat inside my army greatcoat. So I used to have this thing, and I used to feel like a rubber chicken, you know, this thing, just stripping off the coat, you know, and
show the lining.
To show the lining. Yeah, it was wonderful. Somebody pinched me, of course, you know, as anything. And by then, of course, you had a connection and leaders. Well, not a connection, but you've got, you know, good leaders and different things. You know.
What about the other side of war, Harry, at that stage? Because you're in your story now. Mm. You're getting into August, mid of August something. And I know that about somewhere like the 17th of August or something, you were going through the Falaise Gap.
Oh, yes. Now that was a thing of its own. The Falaise Gap was the most horrendous, nauseating thing that ever worried me, really. I had to ride with a cargo of and a thing wrapped round and everything like that because of the dead bodies. You rode over the dead bodies. You had to, or the horses which bloated and everything was not, because in the famous gap, the 9th Army Brigade, whatever it was, couldn't get away fast enough because of the blockage, in theory, just as simple as that, blockage at one end. You know, in other words, incidentally, the Germans had an enormous amount of horse-drawn vehicles of various, you know, lorries and everything like that. And on top of one of these horse-drawn things which had broken down and helped to pile up everything behind, everything piled up, and so, there was a horse climbing over a tank, over a tank, you know, and somebody shot it.